Transmission will start in 5 seconds from now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, in.
Hello and welcome to episode 27 of the Roy Harper podcast. My name's Paul Davison and I run the website www.stormcock.net. In this show, we'll have part one of a two-part interview with Mark Bishop, known to some of you as Marco on the mailing list. The A to Z of Harper, this time it's the letter Z. We'll have a medium wave archive transmission from Radio Scotland from a programme called Jump the Queue, which features an interview with both Roy and Nick from 1994. We'll have plenty of listener feedback, including some more radio snippets from our roving radio reporter Keith Bedford, and of course a selection of music. Firstly, by way of an editorial, some of you will know that listened last month that I said I was going to be reducing the frequency of the podcast from monthly down to whenever I had loads of stuff ready. And as you will have gathered, this podcast is a few weeks late and it's all happened a bit quickly, really. But some of you will know that I've been self-employed for a number of years, in fact running my own company, Missile Thrush Limited, named after Stormcock, of course. Well, for the last few years, I've been doing, I don't know, 80% of my work for one particular large customer. And during September, they made the announcement that they were trying to lay off most of their contractor staff. But they were, in fact, going to be offering permanent jobs to those of their contractors that they valued highly. Well, to cut a long story short, I was one of the highly valued contractors, which was lucky for me, I suppose. So I got offered a permanent job. The money is not as good as I was earning as a contractor. In fact, I'm going to have to pull my belt in for a little while until I've sort of, you know, got back onto an even keel and hopefully proved myself and got a pay rise. But I decided that in the current economic climate, it was probably worth doing this to make sure I had some financial stability for the next few months, hopefully while the economy recovers. So I'm now a full-time employee of a particular networking company. I'm still doing bits of consultancy as well, particularly on the in the web arena, which they're happy to have carry on as long as there's no conflict of interest. So I'm still doing stuff, but I'm in the middle of working out whether to keep Missile Thrush Limited going or whether to put it in dormancy for a while, whether to do my outside work as a self-employed person rather than as a company, all that kind of stuff. So that's been using up quite a lot of my spare time, and also I've had to do some initial meetings and I've had to travel and do stuff. I was in Amsterdam actually earlier this week, which wasn't quite as much fun as it sounds because I was stuck in meetings basically for 2 full days, meeting people and working out where I fitted into the the larger scheme of things. So I've been rushed off my feet. Hence, I haven't had time to finish off this podcast, although most of the preparatory work has been ready for some time. So hopefully that's by way of an explanation for those of you that have been wondering what's going on. And I know I owe one or two of you some emails, and one or two of you I owe something in the post as well, which I'll get to very shortly on Gov. Okay, we're going to kick off, I think, with the Radio Scotland interview. Now, I got this off the internet from a dodgy place, so to speak, and it is off medium wave, so the audio quality is quite poor. I've done a little bit of cleanup on the audio, actually, so if you happen to have got the original, hopefully this one will sound slightly better, but it does fade in and out a bit. But I think it's very interesting from a historical point of view, not least because Nick was still quite new to his career and still rather shy and subdued, which definitely isn't the case these days. So, here we go.
...in these programs to get to meet some of your heroes and some people that, in this next case, somebody I've been listening to since I was a very small child, actually. Roy Harper came to us and played a session along with his son, Nick, and I think I'll address the tape at this point. What's this first song, Roy?
This is a song called... what is this song called? Commune?
Oh, Commune, yes. It was going to be a very important song once, and it was sort of, then the tide came in. No, sorry, then the tide went out. Anyway. And the tide came back in again. I look back down behind me, with hair like the ripe in which she came, sure as the west wind to find me. Just for a moment I wished my life to see our friends all around us, and I turned to her, but I held my breath in the far Norwegian mountains. For there we stood, two children of spring, as everything seemed to be gleaming, her looking breathless, clean out of my mind, me with my crazy dreaming. To think of my friends underneath the same roof, in one common destination, when all we do is remain aloof, like we have no close relation. My torment, and I'll take when I can, but I'll give in the moment when you are my woman and I am your man. Watched her making her first daisy chain, as her nipples hung hard in suggestion. Naked, net bitten, we drifted the plane in the hazy desert of sensation. We dreamt of all the loves we'd known. We never, never thought of the sorrow. With forelocks wound on the primrose down in the wood by the empty long barrow. Silver green flies to flicker the backdropping blush of the emerald springtime. To lust for a moment in love of another as dust on a dragonfly's wing. And love is my torment, and I'll take when I can, but I'll give in the moment when you are my woman and I am your man. The black cap sings and the forest rings, the nettles tall around me, the shafts of sun and moving things, and poems fast and slowly, and fantasies of luscious thirst for new lust and fresh waters to seek it, like diamonds set in realities. Sky is drawn back in secret, but somewhere out there was my heart in her care, and her prayers in the breezes that caught them. She sits like the earth as I fly to her arms, like the showering yellows of autumn. And love is no torment, for we'll give can, and we'll live for the moment when she is my woman and I am her man.
Lead.
quite unmistakable sound of Roy Harper playing live for us there. Roy, I know that a lot of your back catalogue, which has been reissued in the past, is now going to be reactivated again on your own label, I believe.
Yeah, Science Friction.
Mm. I guess a lot of the songs from those days, you know, you still perform regularly in your live shows and so on, and they've evolved over the years in different ways.
Some of them are better than they used to be.
How do you feel in that case going back to some of the old albums and listening to the master tapes?
Oh, I never listen to them. I never. Once you've made a record, you don't listen to it.
Mm.
I never listen to my own records. One of the banes, one of the problems of being a girlfriend of mine is that you don't get to listen to my music anymore. Which, you know, I've noticed that various girlfriends haven't really enjoyed. They've enjoyed the time when they were listening to the songs and listening to my records, rather than the time when I was about, when I said, oh, take that junk off.
Well, we've got your son, Nick Harper, with us now. He's got his own record out too, and has been living, I guess, with Roy's music for, well, all your life. How do you feel suddenly, you know, over the last few years being out on the road with your dad and doing the kind of performances that you've been working on in Scotland over the last few days?
Well, it's an enormous privilege, really, to play such great songs and discussing nepotism at the same time.
Yeah.
No, it's great fun.
So you've got this this six track mini album, is it, or maxi single, or what is it? Light at the End of the Kennel. Tell me about this.
It's just a few songs, banged down, just guitar and vocals, keeping the family tradition going. Love songs, mainly.
You know, it's a funny thing, Roy, before we started this, he was gassing away good stuff in the corner.
Yeah,
said,
once
the tape rolls.
I haven't had enough meth.
Yeah, there's a bottle of meth hanging around here on this set. What is that bottle of meth, John?
Strictly for clean tape recorders.
Right.
That's crazy stuff. Yeah, but it does a great job on tape heads.
Does it?
Really? We're supposed to use a different kind of spirit for that, you know?
I think we should have another song here, actually.
I'm bottling out of this discussion.
It's a plastic bottle as well. What?
Put some change for the bus fare.
Oh, goodness. I think it's also one of the things that we have is a relationship that's more like brothers than, you know, parent, child sort of thing. And that's the way I view it anyway, because I always think of myself as being a bit silly anyway. You know, I'm not the world's most grown-up person. You know, so,
For which we must all be thankful, I would say.
So, you know, I'm very grateful to have, sometimes to have other adults around me, you know. And Nick is definitely an adult, so, you know, we kind of mix it and match it.
Well, somebody once said, grown-ups are just silly children.
Anybody can see it. Well, we'll give over the Elvis impersonation right now and go to a song that I wrote for his great-grandfather, who was a very good cricketer. And actually, I was made a member, an honorary member of Haddington Cricket Club. It's the only membership of any cricket club I've ever had, and it's in Scotland. That's weird. And that's because I'd let them use the song on a, and I've lost contact with them, and I shouldn't have done, really. I should have actually maintained some sort of contact and gone up there. And
Fish lives up there now.
Yeah, his studios are there too.
Yeah,
it's not so many miles away. Now's your chance.
And now's my chance to actually go up in the summer and have a few drinks with Fish and go off and see Haddington get defeated.
When the day is done and the balls are spun in the umpire's pocket away, all remains in the groundsman's face for the rest of time and a day.
There'll be one mad dog and his master pushing for four with a spin on a dusty pitch with 2 pound cakes of willow wood in the sun. When an old cricketer leaves the crease, well, you never know whether he's gone. Sometimes you're catching a fleeting glimpse of a 12-minute sail he made on. It could be Jeff and it could be John, with a new ball sting in his tail. And it could be me, it could be, and it could be the sting in the air, the sting in the air. Gathering stands, and the clock turns back to reflect on those years of grace as the footsteps trace for the last time out of the air. Well, this way of life's recollection, a hallowed strip in the haze. Tabled men and the noonday sun are much more than just yarns of their days. When an old cricketer leaves the crease, oh, well, you never know whether he's gone. Sometimes you're catching a fleeting glimpse of a 12-minute silly middle. It could be Jeff, it could be John, with an evil sting in his tail. It could be me, it could be, it could be the sting in the air, the sting. When an old cricket leaves the crease, well, you never know whether he's gone. Sometimes you're catching a fleeting glimpse of a 12-minute silly mid-arm. It could be me, it could be thee. Silly mid-arm, silly mid-arm, silly man.
When an old cricketer leaves the crease. And I know it seems like a bit of a DJ thing to do, to play a record called This Charming Man after we just heard from Roy Harper, but Roy Harper was a charming man, and here come the Smiths, because after all, I'm a DJ.
Hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was well worth a listen, despite the very poor audio quality in places. Now on to our interview. So this month, my interview guest is Marco, who a lot of people on the mailing list will know. He's been around for a few years, and we've encountered each other at various interesting gigs, which we'll get to in a minute. But hi there, Marco. How are you doing?
Hi there. I'm doing fine. Enjoying the lovely sunny afternoon in London.
Yeah. So let's start off with a quick intro. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Many people on Stormcock know me as Marco. My real name, I guess, is Mark Bishop, and what I do for a living, I'm lucky enough to have a great job, which is I'm a reader in cognitive computing at Goldsmiths, which is part of the University of London, where I run an MSc in the same subject. And for those of you who might be interested, cognitive computing sets itself the grand task of trying to work out how the mind works, or put more simply, how you know what you're going to say or think next.
So being a reader means you get paid to sit around reading books all day, is that right?
I wish. I think in ye olden days of academia, that's what it meant. But it's just an honorary title now that sort of just means you're just one below the professor level in academia.
Oh, very good. So you're shooting to be prof at some point, are you?
In my dreams.
Okay, so let's get on to the music. Now, you've done an awful lot of preparation for this interview, more than anybody has in the past, ever. So we'll walk through your list, and the first thing we've got here is my first Roy gig.
Yeah, it was a mad event. It was in 1983, and around that time I was really interested in going to rock festivals, and around June every year there's a really great one, a free one, at Stonehenge in Cheshire. And that year I'd gone with a big group of friends who'd never been to Stonehenge before, college friends and people from around town. And when I arrived there, we set up, and this guy from New Zealand, who was a friend of a friend, said to me, "Guess what? I just found this guy Roy Harper's playing. You've got to go and see him. He's amazing." And I said, "Well, I can't remember. I don't think I've ever heard of Roy Harper before. What's he done?" And he said, "Well, you must know him. He did that track Cricketer." And that sort of fired off a few brain cells. I vaguely remembered hearing Cricketer on the radio and thinking, that's okay. But it didn't ever sort of inspire me to go and dig any further at the time. And then, of course, out of the blue, my friend said, "Oh, you must have seen the reference to Roy on the Led Zeppelin record." And I had.
Right.
So that persuaded me to go along and actually see him on stage. And it was a lovely day, and Roy was in fine form, as I now realise. And I think my first track was One Man Rock and Roll Band. And from the moment he started,
not a bad start.
It was an amazing start. I just couldn't believe from the second he started playing, I was bewitched and hooked. And I guess I've been hooked into Roy's music ever since.
Those Stonehenge festivals don't happen anymore.
Sadly not. There was another one in 1984, which I was able to get to. And then, of course, you had the famous Battle of the Beanfield when the Thatcher government of the day decided to put an end once and for all to the Stonehenge festivals. The conspiracy theorists amongst us believe this was in part due to the fact that had the 85 festival gone ahead, there was an ancient statute that meant that the festival would have been eligible for some kind of charter, which would have meant it would have been impossible to have stopped in the future.
Oh, right.
Now, whether that's true or not, I don't really know, but that was the rumour that was doing the rounds. But in any event, obviously, the police who came to stop it that year were flush with success of their confrontations in the miners' dispute, and pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And I'm ashamed to say I wasn't there at the Battle of Greenfield. I chickened out. I thought there might be some serious violence, which there was.
Oh, right.
But then I managed to get... A couple of days later, there was a little mini festival at the White Horse in Wiltshire, where the bedraggled remnants of the people who tried to make it to Stonehenge ended up going and camping.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I managed to get down to that and have great memories of seeing Hawkwind play in a tiny little stage.
Hawkwind would turn up anywhere, wouldn't they?
They would and they did. Yeah, I think they were partly involved in getting the stage and stuff together for Stonehenge, so they had some pretty strong connections to the old festival. And every year I went, which was 80 to 84, they always played and usually played more than once. Sometimes you see them at sort of 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and then they often play again at sunrise. So I think they were pretty keen on the festival themselves.
No, not bad for an old bunch of prog rockers, that's what I mean.
Those of you who are listening who have read the list will know that certain Al Rose and myself strongly don't believe that Hawkwind prog rock. We like to think of them as psychedelic rock or something of that.
Or space rock or something.
Or space rock even, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Space opera. Space opera.
Okay, well, all right, so you went to Stonehenge, you saw him.
Yep.
Obviously, it had an effect on you. So what was the next step?
Well, the most immediate effect was that prior to going to Stonehenge that year, I was in a little band myself and played guitar and wrote lyrics and things like that.
Mm.
And after seeing Roy, I just lost all interest, certainly at lyric writing, because some of his songs, I'm thinking particularly of McGowan's Blues, I Hate the White Man, the sort of strident protest songs, observations of the ills of society were so close to the sort of thing I was trying to write in a very poor way that it just sort of thought, well, there's no point, anything I could do would only be a poor imitation of this brilliant lyrics that Roy's producing. So it sort of kind of stopped me writing for many years until my own muse moved into a different direction, I guess.
That's actually really sad in a way.
I don't think it is. I mean, it's like Roy expressed all these things that I wanted to express so to me perfectly. I couldn't conceive of it, not just me, I couldn't conceive of anybody doing it any better. So that's what pulled me into him so strongly from that first second I saw him. I was just utterly hooked. I guess I'm someone who, although I play guitar, I'm really interested in lyrics, and Roy's lyrics just really did it for me from day one. And so I don't really look at it as sad at all. I mean, at some point in time, since then, I started writing again, but that's because my own interests diverged away from that kind of sort of strident protest song that I was into back in 1983 and 84, I guess.
Oh, right. Yeah, you hear similar things from people that go and see Nick Harper who are interested in playing guitar, and they say, right, I'm not picking that bloody thing up again, you know.
I heard a classic quote, I'm from the Northeast originally, although my accent is pretty well gone, I guess, now. But
it's still there a bit.
Yeah, I went to see Nick at a gig in a place called Stockton in Teesside. And I heard there's this old geezer there, must have been, I don't know, 65, 70 year old. And I followed him into the toilets at half time to get rid of some of the beers I'd been quoffing. And he turns to me and says, dear God, that lad certainly knows his way up and down the fretboard, doesn't he? And I reckon he certainly does.
Okay, so. Second point is finding the records, and I think you may have a similar story to mine here.
Yeah, I don't know how. I don't know whether Roy attracts a certain sort of record collector, the completest record collector, because I've gone through all the podcasts and enjoyed listening to them all, and certainly a number of people have suggested that or have stated that they're really interested in collecting all of Roy's output, and certainly for me, that was definitely the case. As soon as I got into him and watched him, I just wanted to get as much of his material as I could.
Mm.
But certainly back in between 1983 on that first gig, and I didn't see him again until 1984, because at that point I hadn't heard about hors d'oeuvres, I hadn't heard about the gig list, and certainly the internet distribution list was many years in the future. So for me, even finding when Roy was playing was really difficult.
Yeah.
And I certainly had great trouble getting his records. And I think my first couple were Unknown Soldier, and followed by Work of Heart, which I didn't particularly like. It left sort of weird taste in my mouth, I think, as you and other people have commented.
Yeah, very much so.
It seemed a bit overproduced to me, that one. And but Unknown Soldier, I kind of enjoyed this. I there's some tracks that I immediately fell in love with.
The title track is excellent.
Yeah, I particularly like Short and Sweet. I really
like. Oh, yeah.
And the one about his garden. I've lost my memory at the moment. Firecatcher, that's
right. Oh, right, yeah.
But I couldn't get anything else. And And then by some strange coincidence, I was living in a shared house at the time in Reading, and this guy goes to me, oh, I've got an old, I used to like Roy Harper when I was a kid, I've got an old double live LP of his that I don't listen to anymore. You're welcome to have that if you want. So I got hold of Flashes, which was just fantastic, exactly what I was after.
Oh, that's great. And also, that actually was very rare at that time as well. You'd find it at record fairs. I had a friend, Simon, found a copy at a record fair, and it was like, I don't know, 30 quid or something, which is...
Well, the amusing thing is, the person who gave it to me demanded it back when he left the building. I think he must have realised that it was worth a pound or two. But I won't shame him by mentioning his name. But, I was able to get a tape of that until I was able to find it on CD, albeit that's not perhaps quite as good a medium to listen to it on, many years later. So that was a very treasured possession, that tape, for many years, because Flashes has so many of my favourite tunes on them.
Also it's a good sort of mixture of live styles as well, because some of it's very gentle and some of it's completely chaotic, which kind of is what you get, I suppose.
I guess, yeah, in a Roy gig. It was just an awesome work. Mm. So, and then gradually, I guess after 84, 85, I began to connect to the Roy Harper community at large a little bit. And then that led to more looking, finding records, as you say, at record fairs and the odd record shop around the country. And over the years, I managed to build up to what is now, I think, pretty well a complete set of Roy's output, except I haven't got all of the BBC sessions.
Right.
I think I got sort of switched off some of the live stuff, because when I used to go, after 1984, I began to see Roy a lot around the country, like some mad deranged stalker fan. I started going to every gig on the tour. I was a postgraduate at the time, and I was able to take quite large periods of time away from my work and just literally go, start off at the beginning of the tour and just go to pretty well every gig. And I soon bored all my mates rigid with anecdotes of these tours and endless plays of the few Roy Harper LPs I had. I remember vividly on one particular tour, I met up with a fellow group of nutters who were also following Roy around the country, people I didn't know. I don't know whether this still goes on these days, but yeah. Roy's not touring anymore now, but whether there's something like that happens for Nick. But it was a group of us that went around together for a while, and I remember they had some particularly interesting mushroom soup, which we shared one time, and that put a certain interesting twang on one of Roy's performances in a small folk club in the southwest of America.
I suppose one question that people haven't seen him live that much might ask is, did you not get bored seeing him play night after night after night?
God, no. And I'm pretty certain you've experienced this as well, Paul. But I mean, in those days, I mean, perhaps it's my memory playing tricks, and perhaps it wasn't really like this, but my memory of those events is that roughly two-thirds of the material would be the same as the previous night, but one-third would be utterly random, depending on what the audience shouted out. If he'd played exactly the same set every night, even I, as a mad deranged stalker completist fan, would have surely got bored after two or three nights. But to me, every Roy gig was a different and amazing experience, sort of drug that I just couldn't get enough of at that time in my life.
I also think that it's partly the in-between song chat somehow, because it's this whole dynamic event and there's this whole communication going on. Everyone is different for that as well, and that is something really special, and you don't get that with very many performers, I don't think.
No, I mean, I think you do get a better class of heckler at a Roy gig. You also get some particularly grim ones as well, of which we best not mention any names, but you do get some very entertaining comments, and if Roy can hear them, he's a master of the witty retort or withering put down, as the case points. But so yeah, I guess over the years I must have been to, I don't know, something over 50 gigs, I guess, quite a few anyway. But I know there are many people on the list for whom 50 is a mere bagatelle, a mere nothing.
Maybe. I mean, it helps if there's some fans, I think, that had special abilities to get to gigs involving free train passes and all sorts of stuff like that. So, you know, I know a couple that hadn't had that. You also talked a little bit about making bootlegs of the gigs. Not for profit, of course, but for your own kind of enjoyment, really.
Yeah, I mean, again, this stemmed from the time when I was finding it difficult to buy legitimate Roy material, and the only way I could listen to it was by making my own tapes. And I mean, I've only once ever even passed on a tape to anybody else, and that was somebody on the list who had a great, who needed to listen to a particular show that I happened to have a tape on.
Right.
So they mainly stayed on my shelves. Not many other people, other than some of my friends who've had to be made to listen to them on more than one occasion. I haven't personally really listened to these things. But I have quite a lot of them, and I've always thought that, I know at the end of this chat, you'll probably ask me about thoughts to do with the music business. It's a sort of traditional question, I guess. But just to sort of preempt that by a few minutes, something I've always thought that artists could do, and I think Roy would be a great case for this, would be to perhaps ask fans to send him their bootlegs of concerts in the past, and for him to maintain an archive of these, for which he could perhaps charge £1 or 50p or whatever for people to download, and it would generate another income stream for him. And it would also have the effect that you build this archive up of Roy's material, and if you think how valuable, say, the Led Zeppelin archive has been, you know, videos, people, fans have sent in videos and odd music clips that they've had, and I believe some of that's actually been used on the last Led Zeppelin DVD.
That's right, they did use some bootleg footage and stuff.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that there could be historical reasons if we think, you know, people are going to be listening to Roy in 50 or 100 years' time, and I'm pretty certain there will be. You know, I think it'd be good to try and get an archive started now while people are, you know, still have the material to hand.
Well, I'll tell you what I think about it, and I have spoken to him about live stuff in the past, and I've tried to get him interested in this whole idea about downloading, and he's got a lot of tapes, proper mixing desk tapes, yeah, of gigs. The main stumbling block, I think, is he is a complete perfectionist, and I think he'd find it very difficult to take his hand off the controls and just put something out. I think, do you remember
a complete perfectionist? What happened in the Dream Society? Something must have gone badly wrong.
Hey, that's a really good album, that. What are you talking about, man?
The Dream Society, to me, is what the Green Man is to L, I'm afraid. I played it twice, ever. That was two times too often in my book.
We'll get onto the Green Man in a minute. I think that there will be downloadable music at some point, but I don't know whether it will go to the extent of doing live stuff. But I really wish it would. I think it's a great idea.
Well, I mean, is it Nick that's mentioned on your interview that these days his main income stream is from live music? He doesn't really make that much from his CD releases.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the same applies to Roy, but I would imagine an artist of Roy and Nick's stature would jump at another new untapped income stream too.
Well, it's all about finding other, as you say, other income methods these days. You know, some artists are like setting up special little clubs for people that they subscribe to, and you know, you've got to think outside the box, as that awful saying goes.
Well, was it Meridian who got their fans to pay for an album?
That's right. That's right. Interesting. All right. Your next thing is talking about your favourite Roy era live sound, and you've said that you like the Once era. Why is that?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I don't know how many of the listeners had a chance to see Roy around that time that Once was released, but to me, I just absolutely fell in love with the production that I believe Jackie was mixing. I'm not too certain.
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
And I believe Jackie was mixing them in those days, and it was like her and Roy had this amazing telepathic relationship. It seemed to me as a punter who was just going along to listen to the sound, and what she did with the mixing was sort of turned Roy from being one man with an acoustic guitar into the proverbial one man rock and roll band. And the number of friends I dragged along to see Roy in those days who were just blown away, literally, A, by the beauty of his music and the power of his lyrics, but also by the sheer volume of the PA. Anyone who went to some of those gigs will know they were bloody loud and at certain points in time. And equally, well, very soft and gentle at other points in the night. And I just absolutely loved the way that Roy performed live at that point, at that era.
I think there's a good representation of that, actually, on the Burn the World live track.
Yes.
Because that was mixed by her, and he... If you turn that up, it's got so much dynamic quality to it, and it does actually blow your head off at the end. And I remember there was some gigs at the Bloomsbury, and they had these posters up because there'd been a review of one of the live gigs by somebody, and it might even have been from some bizarre magazine like Kerrang or something. and the quote was, "Roy Harper blew my head off."
Wasn't that where Al Rose used to work? Was it Kerrang or something like that? Perhaps it was her.
I don't think it was, but if it was, well done to Al.
But yeah, he used to blow your head off, and when he cranked it up a bit for some of the louder tracks, definitely. And it was just an effect. I've never seen at that point in my life, and even since then, I've never seen one man and a guitar make a sound like Roy and Jackie conjured up then. Yeah. And for me, I think you're not that keen on it, if I recall, but I also quite liked the Once video, which I felt gave a pretty reasonable portrayal of, certainly audio-wise, what it was sounding like in those days. I know some people have critiqued the video saying it's a bit cold. I remember Roy saying that he felt cold that night. But I felt the actual sound on that, it was reasonably representative of the wall of sound thing. But I don't know whether that was made after Roy and Jackie split off.
I can't remember. But to be honest, I think the problem I have with it is not the performance or anything. I just remember that the gig happened the night that Margaret Thatcher resigned. And I kind of got myself into this mental state where I was expecting a completely riotous party almost.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like that, and he hardly alluded to it as far as I can remember. And I think I was just so surprised by that I keep remembering that when I watch the video. So it's an associative thing, you know.
That's so interesting you mentioned that, because I had a big debate with a couple of people from the list, James and Al at Croppredy this year, I find it very difficult, and perhaps some of your Tory listeners might be able to write in and explain how this works.
And there are some.
I just find it conceptually strange how someone who is politically to the right of centre and, say, reads an August organ like the Telegraph or something can get into going to see Roy, when I have so many memories, especially of those early days in the mid-80s when Thatcher was in mid-flow and the miners were being kicked around and civil liberties were being trampled on. And Roy's gigs were so political. At the end of every gig, he used to stand up and say, can you do something to help bring the bloody government down? And things like that every time. And certainly, had I been a conservative, I would have felt a bit awkward to be in that situation. So I was always really surprised to find that there are indeed quite a few, I gather, people who enjoy Roy's music who have political views to the right of centre.
I can only assume that they compartmentalise different bits of their lives, and you know, they live politically to the right, but the music somehow they don't. There's some association that they've broken, maybe.
I mean, Neil Young. I mean, I remember I used to really enjoy Neil Young, and then when I heard him at one time saying how great Ronald Reagan was, I just refused to play his music for a while. Bloody fascist as well, that's because he didn't stick his head in the toilet. And I couldn't be bothered to listen to it till a few years later when he sort of seemed to sort of recant on those views a little bit. But to me, music is so embedded in my life, I can't compartmentalise music and politics. The two things are intimately intertwined.
Actually, talking about politics, you wanted to talk very briefly about the Rushdie business, the Salman Rushdie.
Oh, yeah, stuff. That was a mad doings, if I might say it enough.
Mm.
I was really shocked. I don't know whether have you read the Sammy versus Bob?
No, I haven't. I think there's a copy around, but no, I haven't.
Well, I'd actually read it before all the fuss came out. I quite got into Midnight's Children and Shame and some of the texts by Rushdie. And so I bought the book when it came out and read it quickly. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked by it. You know, this is heavy stuff. And I was expecting a backlash. But the weird thing is, the backlash I was expecting was from the British establishment and from the CID, because the book, as far as on my reading of it, was a diatribe against the Thatcher government and also against the British police. And I actually read the bit about the dream about the prophet's wives, and it hardly registered as anything to upset anybody. I just didn't think it was anything to get round about. So I was utterly shocked by the fuss that was made about the book, and about the riots and the subsequent book burnings, and then the fatwa on Rushdie. Yeah. All this was a real shock, and I used to live in a high immigrant part of town in Reading around this period, and probably 50% Asian, if not higher, I guess. And I'd always got on really well with my neighbours and enjoyed being in that sort of multicultural environment, and still do, as it happens. But I remember being quite shocked one day when there was a big march went through the area, and I was standing outside my local Turkish kebab shop, and all of a sudden the guy who owned the shop, who I'd known since he opened it, came out and grabbed me and pulled me in when this great big march went past, with all these people braying for Rushdie's death and what have you. And so that, as a sort of guy who's sort of been brought up pretty libertarian, or evolved libertarian views, certainly about the freedom to write about what you want, this was utterly shocking to me. And I was sitting around waiting for the British artistic community to respond to this. If you recall, certainly with the rise in fascism in Spain, we had a historical response by the union movement in this country. A lot of people went over to fight fascism in Spain. Yes. And I was naively expecting the unions to come out condemning this, and there to be a mass movement literally fighting what to me seemed the fascist kind of ideology, that Rushdie should have this fatwa put against him and the book should be burned. And nothing happened. And I waited and waited and waited, and nothing happened. You had the odd author who might pop up on Newsnight and say how dreadful he found the whole thing, but there just seemed to be nothing really going on. And one particular Roy gig, I think it was a Half Moon gig actually, but I wouldn't swear on it now. Yeah, I think it was Half Moon. I was waiting, I was there with a group of friends waiting for Roy to come on, and I suddenly thought, I can perhaps do a pastiche of Hangman and do that and make a reference to the Rushdie affair. And the inspirations came down, and I wrote a few verses. And I thought, I just wonder whether Roy might be persuaded to change the words to Hangman that night. I had an inkling he was going to play it.
Yeah.
So I gave it to Jackie and sat around and waited, and Roy played Hangman absolutely as normal. And I never heard anything about it again. And so, as you know, Roy must have thought it was utter nonsense that I'd written, or perhaps he didn't agree with the sentiments. And then, of course, Once came along, and we had the Black Cloud of Islam. And I have obviously no way of knowing whether my little pastiche might have fired off some cells of indignation in Roy's mind, if he ever got to read it, that is, or whether it was done completely independently of that little gesture. But whatever, it was interesting that Roy did pen a response to that affair, a very powerful response, and one that at that time in my life I used to really enjoy him and take pride when he sung those lyrics.
It's a strong song, but I must admit, I have always felt that the and this is really nitpicking, but I've always felt the lyrics are a little bit sloppy, actually, because I hate the bit where he says, I haven't read the book, so I cannot recite, but I bet Salman Rushdie was just about right. And I've always thought, that's actually not very good, because it's kind of admitting you haven't read the book, and I thought,
Well, isn't that being truthful, though?
Yeah, I suppose you could see it that way, yeah.
I mean, I just took it as read that presumably Roy. I mean, a lot of people don't like Rushdie's work. It isn't the lightest of bedtime reads, and I could well imagine there's no reason to suppose that Roy or you or anybody else should enjoy it. And just because it's a book that's created controversy doesn't mean that we should all love the writing and enjoy.
That's a good point.
It.
That's a really good point.
I just presume that Roy tried to read it, perhaps, and found it turgid and couldn't be bothered to read anymore, but was incensed by the fact that there'd been the fuss about it.
Right, okay, I can buy into that. All right, next topic. Now, you've got here legendary Islington gigs. What's that all about?
I'm pretty certain you know damn well what this is about. Mr. Paul, I've forgotten the name of the venue. It happened a few years ago, but there was a small club in Islington. I think it was in Islington. I remember that's gone to pot. Where I played, I think, four Sunday nights on the trot. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, was it the garage? Or am I thinking of somewhere else?
That kind of seems to fire a few brain cells. Yeah, right. That sounds cool. And I seem to recall he set different themes each week.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think if you'd got your act together, you could have actually bought a season ticket for all four at the beginning, which would have worked out cheaper. And
You're right. I remember that now.
But of course, being lazy lumpkin like I am and not getting my act together, I didn't do that. But nonetheless, I decided I wanted to go to all these gigs. And I got into the first couple, no problem. And then told my friends, as I always did after I'd seen what happened, right, the gigs, how they just had to come down. And on the third one, I brought a carload of friends from Reading down. And unfortunately, I think it was the third one, it had sold out by the time we got there. Ooh. And I was stood in the queue, I think just, you know, literally three or four people in front of me, they'd sold out at that point. And, oh, God, what can I do? So I put my best Geordie accent on and go to the woman and think, yeah, I've come all the way from Teesside to see Roy, favourite artist of all time. Here are me chums, and we can't get in, and we gutted, what can you do? There must be a few more seats. Anyway, this woman looked at me with due surprise and amusement and said, no, there isn't any way I can let you in. But astonishingly, so I'm told, I wouldn't recognise the person myself, but apparently Roger Walters was in front of us. Oh. And certainly this guy turns to me and says, oh, that's really sad. I say, well, I'll get you in, follow me. So me and my couple of mates, plus a couple of other people who randomly tagged along to our group who I've never seen before, followed Roger Walters downstairs into a seedy office where someone I was told was Vince Power.
Oh, bloody hell.
Was there. And we span the tale again about how we'd come hundreds of miles and Roy was our favourite artist and blah, blah, blah. And the guy goes, well, it is literally packed. I believe there were some celebs in the audience that night, so Vince alluded to.
Mm.
Possibly Robert Plant, would you know anything about that, possibly?
I don't remember seeing him there, but it's quite possible.
Okay, well, anyway, to cut a long story short, they did get us into the venue. It was so rammed, and even though I was a lot thinner then than I am now, you couldn't get a place to sit on the floor or stand on the floor. So my friends literally sat in the bass bins, if you can believe. There were huge bass bins. They sat, and I just leapt on the stage and got a chair and sat behind the bass bins to the left of the stage, just out of sight of most of the audience, hopefully, where I spent the evening rolling herbal cigarettes for the enjoyment of Roy and I believe Nick, who might have guested with him on that night for the rest of the evening. So it was an entertaining evening, and what made it more funny was apparently it was being filmed. I believe were all of those gigs, but I don't know what happened to any of the footage.
That seems to be the case with loads of stuff that's been filmed. I've seen cameras so many times, you never ever get to hear anything about it afterwards.
Yeah, so God knows what happened there. But it was an entertaining evening. My friends were utterly deafened when we met up after the gig.
I was going to ask you that. Could they actually walk at the end of it?
Oh, they were well deafened. I just couldn't believe they sat in the basement for the whole concert. It was astonishing. But they did. And it was an entertaining night out.
That's excellent. Absolutely excellent. You also mentioned the George Robey. I don't think I've ever been there, you know. So I must have missed those.
These are all predicated with the warning that this happened many years ago. And it's possible I might have remembered the name of the venue stroke pub incorrectly. But my jaded memory has it as a place called the Sir George Robey.
Well, that was a big music venue, so you're probably right.
Okay. Well, I've only been there the once. I've never been there before or since. Right. And It was a memorable gig because Roy played his heart out as he usually does.
Mm.
But at the end, everyone, after he'd done his umpteenth encore, carried on shouting for Roy to come back and play more. And he looked a bit drawn that night. And after Gavin was shouting for more and more and more, eventually Jackie comes on stage and spends 5 minutes pointing and berating us as the audience for not to demand more of Roy because he'd given his all that night and he was actually very ill. I believe at the very least he had one of his famous nosebleeds. But it was around the era when I think he had various other things that were causing him issues at the time. And I've never seen... You know, Jackie was really furious with us for trying to put moral pressure on Roy to play another gig, and it kind of stuck with me saying that because I was one of the most guilty with everybody else. Come on, Roy, play some more and all this stuff like I always used to do. And after that, I try to be a bit more restrained now when people are shouting for encores. You know, because artists can only do what they can do. And I recall a debate on Stormcock this one time when one of the regulars was moaning that Roy hadn't been put out an LP for a while. And I wrote back and said, well, you know, there's probably reasons for that. You don't know what's going on in Roy's life. And I think it's a bit cheeky when people try to hassle someone like Roy into doing something just because they desperately want some new output, when really these people don't know what's going on in Roy's life. Albeit I was as guilty as the next man, you know, 15 or 20 years ago.
Well, it's a good point. And one of the things I've become more aware of, because I've got to know him a bit, is, you know, there is actually a... you tend to sort of put these people on a pedestal, these amazing artists, and you forget that there's just an ordinary human there as well, you know, that just happens to have these amazing abilities. And lots of bands and lots of players kind of don't give their all when they play live, I don't think. They kind of go through the motions a bit. But Roy, you know that he's really putting everything into it. And, you know, he's living the songs as he sings them. You can almost see it in his eyes sometimes.
Exactly,
you know, complete commitment.
Yeah, and I think Mick's the same as well. Yeah. I mean, they both put 110% into their live performance. And that, again, to me, is, as you say, it's not something you find every day. It's not something that I think most gigging artists do. They seem to get a bit more jaded. And I used to always find it astonishing at the point in Roy's life when it must have been really weird for him, when he was probably in the 70s being used to playing pretty large venues.
Oh, yeah.
And being a relatively well-known guy, I remember seeing him in the mid-80s when I was in that phase of going to millions of gigs, seeing him in some of the tiniest little folk clubs and how he dealt with that psychologically himself. It must have been quite difficult, you know, wondering, you know, getting out of bed in the morning, are you going to play to 50 or 60 people in the evening?
Yeah.
When 5 years ago you might have been playing to 5,000. You know, it must have been weird, but most of the time when I saw Roy, he never gave away for a second the fact that he might be bored or jaded or pissed off by this change in his circumstances. In fact, only one of my live tapes is there a sort of a hint of weariness I found came through, and that came through only after repeated listenings over many years. I think I thought, perhaps Roy was not quite as happy as he seemed to be on that night. But certainly he gave the illusion, or he created the atmosphere at the time, that he was always giving 110% and always enjoying himself and being, you know, happy to be there.
Yeah, I think you talking about him being ill, I remember when he had that major operation to sort out his circulation and his lung circulation. And he seemed to almost spring back from that full of energy. And, you know, he obviously was suffering before that. That time...
Well, when would that be?
I'm trying to remember, actually. I think... Oh, gosh. Early 90s, I think. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, well, he certainly gave some powerful performances around that. Didn't
yeah. Yeah, he did. The other artist that I think gives his all is Peter Hamill. I don't know whether you've ever seen him play live.
Now, let me just dredge where have I heard that. Is that Van de Graaff?
Yeah, he's the singer in Van de Graaff, but he also plays solo as well. And the first time I saw him, he actually was practically, not screaming, that's not the right word, he was kind of projecting himself somehow from the stage with such energy. He was almost vibrating. You can almost see a sort of you know, electric current running through him. It's amazing, absolutely amazing.
Well, you'll laugh, but I saw him only once and by accident supporting a well-known psychedelic rock band in Reading in the very early, probably 81,
right,
the era when Hawkwind had Ginger Baker drumming the
band. Oh yeah, yeah.
It didn't last long, but they played this dodgy venue in Reading around 81. In fact, it was 1980,
I
think. Yeah. And, Peter Hamill was supporting. I'd been and that's when I was informed that he was had that link to Van de Graaff.
Oh, right.
But opposite of it is for me to say, I'm afraid his music sort of washed in one ear and came out the other, and well, I headed to the bar, I'm afraid.
I mean, he's got enormous amounts of recorded material. He's been really prolific. And some of it's good and some of it's awful, you know.
Is it stuff that you really need to know it before you can begin to appreciate it?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, yes, and I think that's true. So if you go in cold, it's very difficult. I think that's the case with a lot of artists, actually.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling my girlfriend about Roy, but despite 8,000 million plays, she still doesn't like Roy Harper. She likes Nick, but she does not like Roy Harper.
Yeah, well, in a lot of cases, it's the voice that puts people off.
That's exactly it. And in her case, she says, it hasn't got any choruses. It hasn't the words don't rhyme and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's right. Where's the tune in that?
Exactly.
Well, it's probably a lost cause, Marco.
sadly, so.
Talking of Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about Nick for a little while. How did you first... Because I know you're a big fan of Nick as well. How did you first encounter... Hope you enjoyed that first part of the interview with Marco. I had a lot of fun talking to him, as you can probably tell, and I think part two is equally, if not more, interesting than that. Now, we have an unusual music selection. Marco gave me a recording that he made at one of the Stonehenge festivals of Roy playing Short and Sweet with a band, and I wouldn't normally play bootleg recordings on the podcast, but I think this is a really interesting historical document. Now, it does also include a lot of background noise, so you have to kind of, you know, lie down if you've got the opportunity, close your eyes, imagine yourself in a sun-soaked, hopefully, field near Stonehenge with Roy playing. See if you can get yourself transported into the moment.
watching the darkened sky. Who knows? Helpless as time itself to hold.
Hope you enjoyed that. I can't help but wonder whether that lady ever went to the toilet or went to see Enid or Hawkwind or went for a walk on her own. Perhaps Marco can let us know. I don't actually know offhand who's playing in that band. Please write in if you know. Be interested to find out. Now, the A to Z of Harper, it's been a long journey through all 26 letters of the alphabet. We're finally at Z, and I've picked an easy one here. It's Zen Gem, which is a very early track from Roy. And in the lyric book, Roy says, a 60s storyboard of Fordwich Road, NW2, and the Kilburn High Road. Wish I could make the film now. I wrote the following for the CD notes. This always reminds me of Lenny Bruce in the age of Gene Krupa. Miles was on the turntable daily. I had an old Blue Note record that I had nearly worn out by Miles and Cannonball Adderley called Something Else. I played it on ceremonial occasions, every day, with volume. Got into every breath. My journey into sounds inspired me. I wondered why people like Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso had never picked guitars up. I played a mean air trumpet and I'd almost entirely discounted the noble eightfold path. My mind ran like the wind.
You can see the crazy little dog sniffing all the wet trees, following the noisy little boy sneaking down the high street. Flash past the grotty bed and shops, everybody losing. Kilburn, still burn. Baby's hanging off his mummy's stocking tops, grubbing on the knickers with his lollipops, lemon drops, sleepy cops. Church across the street, he's got a bell and a Quasimodo. You can hear them swing together now every Sunday mono. But I'm trying to get some kip and I just don't want to know. Get the hell out.
if I was making a lot of noise. Would you be pleased? Pain relieved or brain disease? Oh, what a very strange society everybody lives in. Swapping bits of paper for the difficulties of living. How much for a beautiful body? How much for a beating? And how much for meaning? Well, I'm afraid you kicked me in the mental crutch. Saw my little brain out with your half on lush. Nothing much, but what a touch. Oh, dearie, dearie me.
Now it's time for listener feedback, and I've got a fair amount to get through this time, which is good. First of all, I have a message from Mark. He says, Paul, may I simply say how much I've appreciated the podcast during the last couple of years, and also how disappointed I was to hear that it will no longer be appearing monthly. I feel somewhat guilty in that I've never posted feedback or left a voicemail, your clear and favoured option. Possibly I've been guilty of taking you for granted, and I apologise. I remember hearing Roy in a record booth in Bath, Stormcock, in 1972. I first saw him in Oxford the following year, supported by a rather twee but wonderful Judy Seal. I remember the shock when I discovered what a schizophrenic personality Roy was, or is, one moment tender and lovely, another day, and the next shouting at the audience in a frankly bonkers way. I've seen him lots since, in clubs, concert halls, and once in a field in Suffolk. I've seen him perform with Andy Roberts, Trigger, Spedding Bruford, etc. Once with a female bassist, his partner, dunno. And of course with Nick. The last time was at his birthday bash at the RFH, which brought tears to my eyes. Even his most frustrating, for me it's usually when I get more speech than music. I've always found something to enjoy, to ponder and to smile about, usually all three. Your podcasts have obviously been entertaining and, like Roy, at times frustrating, and have encouraged me to go back and investigate music I've sometimes forgotten about. Perhaps more importantly, there have been a monthly opportunity for me to reconnect with the thoughts, aspirations and opinions of that younger me who first heard Roy all those years ago. Thank you again, Mark. Thank you, Mark. And I love what you said about going back and reconnecting with earlier thoughts and aspirations. I agree absolutely wholeheartedly. And one of the nice things about doing the podcast is it makes me revisit old tracks and think a lot about what happened in, a few years ago. Feedback from Sean, following up from the interview that Dave Burnham did with Roy, which I had on the last podcast. He says, I corresponded with Dave a while ago now and told him how much I'd enjoyed the interviews and articles on his website. If anyone hasn't visited his site, it's well worth a visit. It's a real Roy Harper treasure trove. I'd read this interview, so it was great to hear it in the flesh, as it were. Loved Roy's impression of Keith Moon explaining the chemically engineered evening that was in store for him. Take those two right now, and that'll put you in an upward direction. Classic. Thanks for that, Paul, and of course Dave and Sue Burnham. Great choice of music too. Love the Matt Churchill intro, Elizabeth, MCP Blues, and You Don't Need Money. It can't really get any better than this, Paul, can it? Well, we'll have to wait and see, Sean. Now, I've also heard from a guy in Australia called Steve Duke, and he's a new listener. And he says, Hi, Paul. Yes, you did read that correctly. A new listener to the podcast from Sydney, Australia. I realise I'm a couple of years late. However, I've only just recently come across Stormcock.net and your series of podcasts. Last week, I had one of my semi-regular business trips to Canberra, about 200 miles each way, and listened to the first four podcasts in the car. I thoroughly enjoyed them and found it interesting to not just find out more about Roy Harper and hear some of his music, but also to get a different perspective on life in the old country. I was particularly delighted to hear your guest Elle use the term pants, which no one in Australia understands by a handful of us expat Brits. Anyway, I just thought I'd let you know I've greatly enjoyed your podcasts and will continue to work my way through them. At some point, I may even catch up. And I hope you keep them coming. Best wishes, Steve. And I heard again from Steve. The first message came on the 12th of September, and the second one came on the 30th of September. Hi, Paul, a quick update. I am now up to episode 14, which I believe makes me about a year behind, but I do want to listen to them in order. I thoroughly enjoyed the interview you did with Roy, and I must say it's one of the most interesting and absorbing pieces of radio. Is that the right term for a podcast? I've heard for a while. And I'm not a Roy Harper nut either, but I must say that the live version of Me and My Woman you played on episode 13 was just brilliant, and I wonder why I never knew this stuff existed when I was younger. However, the thing that particularly inspired me to write back to you was the collection of comments from your friends and associates at Cropperty complaining about the weather being cold, wet and generally shite. At the time of listening, I was walking along Cronulla Beach in Sydney on a glorious spring afternoon, 25 degrees C and clear blue skies. I realised that as much as I miss some things from the mother country, I love listening in living in Australia. Shame that I'll never get to see Roy play here. Anyway, 14 down and about 12 to go. More if I add the other stuff like Nick Harper, Matt Churchill, etc. I haven't been remotely bored by any of it yet, and I'll check in again once I'm further through the series. Best regards, Steve. So, Steve, I don't know when you'll hear this, when you've caught up, I suppose. But thanks a lot for the encouragement, and I'm, you know, great stuff. Thanks for writing. Another message from Peter Jackson, presumably not the famous movie director, but who knows, on the 4th of October. Hello. Just to say how much I appreciate the RH podcast. I'm not that good at downloading or computer things in general, and I've been receiving the podcast since the beginning, but I've just sussed out how to download them on my iPod, so I have been listening to them. In fact, I've not put it down. I started with your last one, but as I got the hang of things, I managed to download quite easily, so I'm starting from the beginning. I had trouble before as it was a family computer and I never had time to fiddle. Anyway, I have my own laptop now and seem to be doing okay. I've even put some RH discs on to listen to. I've been a fan of Roy for as long as I can remember, and I seem to have started with the Rock Machine Turns You On LP. Same as old matey on earlier pod. It all seems to slot in together with other bands, being a big fan of Edgar Broughton Band connections there. Are there any Steve Broughton interviews coming up? Don't know, mate. And I heard Van de Graaff Generator mentioned too, big fan of Hamill. But I have mellowed a bit over the years and listened to quite a diverse range of music. I read on your pages about live recordings. Well, I love live recordings, especially Roy's concerts. Everyone is different, and I have quite a few. I only trade concerts I do not sell, but I have bought some as my needs are great. You could call me a bit of an anorak when it comes to the live stuff, and I'm willing to trade discs. Now, I would put it on your pages, but I'm not sure how, and also most things are done on seeds and things, which is something I know nothing about. He's talking about BitTorrent now, I think. That's why I don't do much trading these days, but I do have a big list of Roy Hamill, VDGG and Cohen with a few others. Do you know any snail mail traders? And if so, could you put me in touch with them? Well, I'm not one to particularly bang on about bootlegs, because I don't really I don't want to encourage what could be construed as illegal trading, I suppose. But I also think that there's no harm in trading stuff freely among fans, for, not for profit, and if it's something that isn't commercially available, that's my personal opinion. So Pete, why not pop on to the stormcot.net forums? There's a live recordings forum in there. Just put a message up there, ask people to send you a private message if they're interested in chatting further, then have a chat via email, and who knows where it goes. He finishes off saying, what I'd really like to say is thanks for taking the trouble. I'm sure there are a lot of fans for the podcast, but we're just too lazy to respond. Take care. Thanks, Pete. I appreciate that. And yes, I think you're right. I know there are a lot of listeners, and I know that most of them never write in. But thanks to those of you that do, and I appreciate you listening. And one final message, this time from Mike Ford. He says, thanks, Paul. By the way, I really appreciate your podcast here in France, but appreciate your decision to take a break. Today is my 47th birthday, but I've been a Roy fan for 33 years. I managed to buy a copy of his Best of 1970 to 75 album when I was 14 and have never looked back. I managed to see Roy in many venues across the UK and travelled from Paris to London for his 60th birthday concert. I've travelled from Lyon to Rochefort to see Nick for the Rochefort en Accord Festival, which was a wonderful weekend, paid for by the royalties of my recent textbook sales. I had the chance to talk to Nick, really nice guy, see a new part of France and listen to some new music. I really recommend it if Nick is coming back next year. My own attempts to get my own kids into RH and NH have failed. My wife is patiently tolerant, but I'm sure there's more time. Thanks again for all your work. Best, Mike. Cheers, Mike. And that concludes the mammoth feedback section. Enjoyed all the correspondence I received about last podcast. Thanks very much. The background music there during the feedback was from a band called Solace, and that was all to do with sword dancing. Quite energetic stuff. Hopefully keep you awake during my long ramblings. Now, as promised, a couple of radio snippets from Keith Bedford. Thanks a lot for sending these in, Keith. And the first one, John Leckie, who produced a number of Roy albums, was a guest on Johnny Walker's show recently, and part of their discussion was about Roy. So here is that snippet.
Guest is record producer John Leckie, who back in the making of that album was a tape operator at EMI Studios in Abbey Road. Well, after years of being at the back of the studio as a tape op, you then moved forward a bit toward the glass as an engineer.
That's right.
And engineered a whole number of things. We got Roy Harper lined up here, and you engineered when you know that great song "When an Old Cricketer Leaves a Crease."
That's right. Yeah, I did. I probably did about 7 records with Roy, you know, through the period, and it was always great fun. I mean, it was always like one man and his acoustic guitar. What can you do with this in the studio? You know, with all the different overdubs and techniques we used, and Roy would often get musicians in, but he was probably at his best when he was just himself with a tape machine where he could overdub his parts and everything. But you know, I have a great affinity to Roy. You know, we've sort of spent a lot of our time together, you know.
Mm-hmm. This song, famously, John Peel asked his producer, John Walters, to make sure it was played at his funeral.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
It's very long. It's 7.5 minutes, so we'll only take just a sample of this. But here's Roy Harper. Such a shame to fade that, but we'll run out of time if we don't. A beautiful song, Roy Harper, and When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease, tape engineered by guest John Leckie. So was that a proper, you know, was that a Colliery Brass Band or something?
It was. It's Grindthorpe Colliery Brass Band. I guess there's about 36 of them. I'm not quite certain how many there were at the time. But no, it was a full brass band that came down from up north in a coach, and we set them up in Studio One at Abbey Road and recorded them with 2 microphones. It's wow. Quite easy because they balance them themselves. Yeah,
such a haunting sound, isn't it?
I know, it's lovely, that record.
Yeah, and then you were engineered Pink Floyd on the Metal album.
That was interesting, and I have to wonder whether John Leckie would be interested in having a chat to me at some point. I wonder if anybody's got any contact info for him. And the second snippet is from Mike Harding's show on BBC Radio 2, and somebody wrote in asking for a Roy track to be played.
Now, here's a track by Roy Harper. I haven't played anything by Roy for a while, mea culpa. I should have done, because he's one of our great singer-songwriters. But a lad called Steve Harper, who's no relative, emailed in saying he wanted to hear some more of him. So for Steve and all the other Roy Harper fans out there, this is Roy with Francesca.
Hey, Francesca, you gave me no warning. Hey, Francesca, tiptoes in the morning. Thanks for leaving the sunshine. Thanks for leaving me. Thanks for being all mine. Thanks for being free. Hey, Francesca.
Well, we're nearly at the end of the podcast. Just the obligatory credits and copyright, and then one final music track. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. Many thanks to Adam Leonard for his intro music, The Great Roy Harper. And background music during the feedback section was by Solace. issued by Magnatune. How can you help the podcast? Well, as usual, you can give us a review on iTunes if you like. A number of you have done this, and I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. If you want to send in a voicemail, then you can email an MP3 file to me, pd@stormcock.net, or you can use a plain old-fashioned telephone. If you're in the UK, it's 01223 850282, or if you're outside the UK, country code 44-1223-850-282. And there's a 90-second limit on those voicemails. And that's pretty much it for this time. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, and I'll see you next time. We've overrun a little bit, but hey, it was worth it, hopefully. Worth the wait. And I'm going to finish off, talking of waiting, with Waiting for Godot, Part Z, from Death or Glory. See you next time. Bye for now.
Youth went a-wooing, fleet of the feet, ran the horizons, living his life out for love, never knowing how fast they could meet. All too soon it was over, gone in a flash, wilted and withered, limping away, out of love, out of time, out of life, at a dash. It won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Waiting for Godot, ravenous cries. For summer is fading, here come the storms. The mirror's got misty, crying my heart out for love, as I lie in the last of her arms. It won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. So let us be gentle, especially with us. Share all our moments, treasure the pleasure of love, as we fathom uncertain, because it won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Waiting for Godot with ravenous cries.